Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 15th, 2002. Today's session is titled, The U.S. Patriot Act. How many civil liberties are you willing to surrender in exchange for security? It is presented by Peter Thompson and Ben Sakamoto. The number is THP 2002-05. Let's listen in.
Which I hope will be a little more like a forum than a session. That is, I would really like to elicit a lot of responses from people about this topic, because, again, it's the kind of topic there isn't a right or a wrong answer. We're going to talk about the balance between national security and civil liberties. My name is Peter Thompson, and I am been running the Resource Center. I'm on long-term staff this past year, and so I've been real involved in issues and forums and in discussions about our country's position after the tragedy of 9/11. And this evening, I'm going to be joined by Ben Sakamoto, who's here on short-term volunteer staff. And the way this particular session evolved is last week we had a forum on some peace issues, and some of the civil liberties kind of issues began to arise, and I was talking to Ben afterwards because I was working with him on carpentry, and discovered for the first time that for 3 years, when he was 9 years old until 12 years old, he was interned by the U.S. government. Ben is a U.S. citizen. He was born to one parent who was Japanese citizen and one parent who is a U.S. citizen, his mom. And he is a longtime Holden supporter. He's been coming up here for years. He's currently on the board of directors of Cancer Lifeline. He's involved with a lot of the nonprofit work of some retired Boeing people. He was an engineer at Boeing for 20 years, which was interrupted for a stint in the U.S. Army in Korea. And before then, he was a farmer from Washington. And before then, when he was a young man, he was put in several camps along with his family. And so, as part, there's really some parallels between some of the things that are going on in our country now in terms of security and what happened back in World War II. And so he's been good enough to share some of those experiences that he had, his own personal experiences and those of his family. And I was, on Saturday, I was down at the dock and I gave 75 cents over to the boat, and they gave me this newspaper, and it just happened on Saturday that the lead story was about a Japanese family here from, I think, the Yakima Valley, where they grow strawberries.
No, this was Skagit.
Skagit Valley. And this was a family that had a similar situation happen, that they were uprooted from their farm, and it's their personal story. And then, interestingly, the next story right underneath, I don't know if they were trying to make a connection or this was just a happenstance, but it says mosque members under investigation. Mm-hmm. You might have been following that. There have been some investigations of a mosque in Seattle. And as I read it, it appeared that there was one fella that has been charged from that mosque, but a lot of the other people just seemed like ordinary people, except they are Muslims. And so it seemed like this was a good time to have a discussion about what your opinions might be about how many of your civil liberties you're willing to give up for more security. And if more security will be coming from all of the increased efforts. I also saw about a week ago that there are some airport security or federal investigators that are testing this security, and some of their preliminary results are they had sent weapons through to try and get them through to see how effective the measures are. And about 3 out of every 4 weapons that they try and get through security are getting through, even though they've stepped up and increased security at the airports. But before we start, for the last 33 years, I've been doing lawyering work back in Minneapolis. So these issues are fairly close to me. I was a federal prosecutor and the federal public defender in Minnesota, and doing criminal defense work as well as human rights work. So I've dealt with the Bill of Rights and some of those things, usually on one side advocating or the other. And so before we start, I just want to see what the important rights you have and treasure as persons who live in the United States of America. Maybe people could kind of name what some of them are. I won't let anyone go to sleep here. We're going to kind of keep everything.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is something to consider.
Pursuit of happiness and
life,
liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That kind of says it all, right?
The right to move about freely, go wherever you want to go.
Freedom of travel.
Right to gather in groups.
Mm-hmm. Assembly, it's called, First Amendment.
Worship.
Mm-hmm. Worship, it's also First Amendment.
Right to bear arms.
Take yourself. Second Amendment.
Free speech.
Free speech is First Amendment. This is going to be pretty good. This is going to be like a law school course on, if you guys get done here, on the Bill of Rights. There's a couple more now. You got to try it. Due process. Excellent. Due process is a little vaguer and broader a term than some of these. Can anyone think of some of what we have come to really assume are some of the rights we have as part of due process, and like in our court system?
Right to an attorney.
Speedy trial.
Speedy trial. Attorney.
Attorney. Silence.
Jury trial appears. Very good.
Well, you're innocent unless proven guilty.
Presumption of innocence. And who's got the burden of proof?
The state.
And what is that?
The prosecutor.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
To be charged with a crime if you're being held.
Right. So that's called notice, generally, under due process. So you have a specific charge, and it's read to you, so you know exactly what the charge is. Very good. There's one more general one. Comes up in the Fourth Amendment. Dennis, what's the Fourth Amendment?
Are you talking about search and seizure?
Yep. And what's the overriding constitutional right? Why do we want
from unreasonable search and seizure?
Right. And that, therefore, we can be secure in our thoughts and our homes and our papers, so it protects our
privacy.
Yes.
Privacy.
Very good. Okay.
What about this, and this might be First Amendment too, to live and work where you choose? Is that part of?
Yeah, I think that's probably part of travel. But the Fifth Amendment. Okay. The Fifth Amendment includes due process and includes public and speedy trial. I didn't get speedy trial up here, did I? Public and speedy. Someone said speedy trial. Fifth Amendment also gives you double jeopardy protections, that is, you can't be charged twice for the same crime. But due process is kind of the big overriding thing. So I think you've really gotten all of the fundamental things that a lot of times we take for granted. And before we hear Ben's story, I just want to mention that it's a hard time when these competing interests arise, because they usually arrive in a crisis kind of situation. And citizens then are in difficult situations. If people dissent or talk about these rights too much, they might be subject to criticism. John Ashcroft, who's now the Attorney General, on December 6th, said that dissent and public debate erode our national unity, diminish our resolve, give ammunition to American enemies, and pause to Americans' friends. And so there really is a real crush to start compromising. And so it's a matter of how far you want to compromise, and you are America. And so how far you want to compromise and what you're willing to do about it really is the question. You saw people probably compromise too far, you know, in the late 30s in Germany. You know, they didn't stand up to say something. I'm not drawing a parallel to what's going on now, but I traveled to Sri Lanka to human rights conventions and to India and into Central America, and oftentimes the government in those places, if they get under stress or attack, particularly from some inside insurgencies, would say, what we're doing is fighting terrorists. These people are terrorists. Now, of course, the terrorists say that, no, we're fighting for, you know, autonomy or independence or things like that. But what would happen in their legal system oftentimes is they would pass emergency acts, not unlike this U.S. Patriot Act that just got passed, to kind of gives more power to the executive and suspends some of these rights. And in those countries, invariably what would happen, and we would be there investigating, would be disappearances or deaths that would occur by people who would be arrested by the governments, and then they wouldn't ever be brought to trial, or they wouldn't ever be seen again. So you would have detention without trial. You wouldn't even get to the niceties of these trials. They would just be locked up. And they would justify that by the crisis and the military problems and the security that was going on in those countries. So there is certainly something to be said for both sides, but it's, you know, where are you going to draw the lines? And
so what you're called a detainee then doesn't apply, huh?
If you're called a detainee, and see, that's just what goes on now. Like, all of the people that are down in Guantanamo Bay, they haven't called them prisoners of war, because that would give them a set of rights under the Geneva Convention. They haven't called them defendants, because they are not citizens. In fact, in one case, there was someone down there who was of split citizenship. His father was Saudi and his mother was U.S., or the other way around. And he kept saying in Guantanamo, I'm a U.S. citizen. You know, you can't do this to me. You have to give me notice of the charges. You have to presume me innocent. I'm entitled to a public jury trial, etc. And they did a bunch of research, and they finally found out that he was. He did have split citizenship, and they did have to bring him up. So what they did is they brought him to the Eastern District of Virginia on purpose, because where he landed was the place they thought he would then have his trial. And the reason they brought him there is that not only is the judiciary quite conservative in that district, that's where all the people from the Pentagon live. And so that's the juries. And it is a stretch for a lot of the prosecutors now, because they don't have a lot of facts. They have suspicions. But it's not going to be easy to prove cases about something that happened in, you know, Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or one place like that.
I think one thing that you don't have up on the board, and it's probably covered in the freedom of speech, is the right of the press
right
to report.
Yep. That is part of the First Amendment, freedom of the press. And it's a very important one, and we hear a lot about it. And it raises some other issues about, I've been getting some reports from the alternative press and looking at a lot of the mainstream press, is that, you know, how accurate is the information that you are getting, or what is stressed, or what comes out. I know there was an article 2 weeks ago that was discussed in another session. It was a session about religious nationalism, and it was a horrible article about what happened to a young woman in some Muslim country and a Muslim court that passed a judgment on her, and the court, the council that passed the judgment on her, decreed that each of them would rape her in front of her husband. And I thought, you know, things like that have been probably going on for years. How come all of a sudden now, you know, it's an article that's prominently displayed? And I'm wondering if that isn't part of a dehumanization of a group of people. As I remember watching the movies during the late stages of World War II and the aftermath of World War II and seeing those old movies, and the Japanese soldiers were, you know, portrayed as anything but human beings.
Well, years ago, there was a book I bought that was called The Faces of the Enemy, and it told about a nation to rally the people to their cause have to demonize the enemy, and through cartoons and slogans and whatever. So it's been going on a long time.
Any question about this structure before we hear from Ben?
Where does the freedom of information, of access to information, or that play any? You know, like you were talking about some of these cases, wouldn't people have, don't we have a freedom of accessing information?
That's a very good question. It's changed since this U.S. Patriot Act got passed last October. For instance, there are about 1,000, at that time, 1,000 Muslim detainees here in this country, and the government didn't give out their names or what they were being held for. And so the American Civil Liberties Union and some other people filed a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act to try and get some of those, some of that data. And they invoked these national security interests and the right for the government to conduct their intelligence work in secret to try and resist that information. And there were volunteer lawyers that were lined up to try and represent those people. And under immigration detention, you don't have a right to a lawyer because it's not a criminal charge like these. And so only if you have an existing relationship and have enough money to have a lawyer could you get a lawyer. So there was a situation where you couldn't even determine who the people were who were in custody, except that the families probably knew that, you know, they weren't home for dinner. Yes, sir.
Where do property rights fit in? Is it under sort of under the due process?
Yeah, you cannot lose property in this country without certain procedures, without due process of law, a fair hearing and adequate compensation and those sort of things. And that comes up a lot of times in condemnation cases, things like that. Jeff?
Well, thank you, Peter. I hope I can do, and I'm sure really help. Nice to see all my friends here and all the support that we have. Thank you very much for coming. I'll start with that. I was born in 1934 in the Yakima Valley in Wapato, Washington. And Wapato, Washington is on a Yakima Indian Reservation. During World War II, my parents, my three brothers and sister, were interned in Portland Assembly Center, and it's over by Jansen Beach, a stockyard, actually. Then we were moved over to Heart Mountain, Wyoming, and taken by train over there. And Heart Mountain, Wyoming is between Cody and Powell, Wyoming. It's over by the east entrance of Yellowstone Park. My grandmother and her two teenage sons were also interned. And so we went, my parents' family and my grandmother and the two sons, we went together as one extended family. We were put into a room, a barracks. Actually, it's a barracks, and we were two side by side adjacent rooms, and they were about 24 by 24 feet. If you can picture one of these lodges in here, 24 by 24 is about like four rooms. Matter of fact, there's a lot of comparison with what Holden Village has. It's very similar to what we were in camp. It was a very communal living area where we did, and there was a central mess hall or dining room like we have here. There was a central laundry and lavatories. We didn't have a lavatory down the end of the hall. But you might kind of, if you can imagine, one of these lodges that we have here, if you didn't have the second floor and just it was all on one floor and it was put end to end, that's about put it about the same size and length. There was six units or six apartments like in each of these barracks, and they were varying sizes, and we were in two, the middle ones, which were the medium-sized barracks, medium-sized rooms within that barrack. That and each section of that had the support for the mess halls and the lavatories housed about 400 people, just like we are right about the same number we have here in the village. The only problem, as I said, that the bathrooms weren't down the end of the hall. They were about 50 yards away. And so if you had to go to the bathroom, you wanted to make sure you planned it, because otherwise you'd never make it. And I don't know whether many of you are familiar with Wyoming winters, but I guess maybe the South Dakotans know, where I can remember where the snow would drift up against the back of a building, and it'd be just as high as Wendell. I mean, it'd be all over. And so it got to be pretty cold. We were fortunate because we were from Yakima Valley, and we had some winter clothing. We were kind of familiar with wintertime clothing. The people from California and Los Angeles and San Jose, they were really hurting because they didn't really know how to take care of themselves. A lot of people got frostbite and stuff like this because they just wasn't familiar with that type of weather. Anyway, to give you a picture of how these units were set up, there were 12 barracks, six to a side, and in the middle was the mess hall and the dining room. And as I said, that took care of about 400 people. Well, if you multiply all these little complexes like this, in Heart Mountain, Wyoming, they had about better than 9,000 people there. We were the third largest town in Wyoming. It was a toss-up between us and Cheyenne, I think. Laramie was always bigger. But anyway, it was a... We were a pretty good force, with a lot of people. We had a high school, we had hospitals and things like this, and so we were kind of a community, as well as each subsection. These little 400 units were kind of a commune. With those 9,000 people that we were plus that we had in Wyoming, there was similar camps throughout the United States. There was nine others. And so in total, it was about 10,000 people, 100,000 people, I'm sorry, of Japanese ancestry. And many of them were American citizens. And again, we weren't, we were all picked up and moved right in there without any due process or buy or leave or anything. It was by fiat. I mean, just an executive order came out and you had to do it. Uh, My next portion of this that I have is my mother's plight there. My mother is was an American citizen. She was born in Washington, in Seattle, Washington. And because she was an American citizen, she used to do a lot of executing legal papers for neighbors, Japanese neighbors and things that didn't couldn't sign for leases and write documents and things like this. Because she was an American citizen, she could do that, and she could also speak English and write English and speak Japanese and write Japanese, and so she was also an interpreter. And so she was sought after for explaining things, because a lot of times you just couldn't quite understand what. And it might be just a simple thing, or it might be a highly complicated thing, and she'd try her best. But I still remember as her just being a full-time mom. Mm-hmm. Now, my father, he had his trials and tribulations. After 1926, they closed the immigration laws so that you couldn't... the Orientals couldn't come in, or the process became very, very, very complicated. And so he was in the Japanese Navy, and then went into the Merchant Marine, and he sailed around the world and things. And when his merchant ship came into Portland, he just walked off the gangplank and just kept going. Anyway, so he ended up in Yakima Valley, where there was some people that he knew from his village, home village in Japan, and so he just tried to kind of disappear in the Japanese community. But as soon as the World War II came, the FBI quickly arrested him. They knew all the different people that that were aliens and leaders of the community, the ministers, any of these. They have clubs like over there for different states or kin that they call them. They have others for different societies and things, and they were looking over everybody of those types. In my father's case, because he was an unregistered alien, they were able to pick him up and hold him in the Yakima County Jail for 90 days. And so that's where he was initially incarcerated. Then after that, they had to move him someplace else, and so they shipped him over to Missoula, Montana. And there, there was a lot of different aliens, Japanese from all over the Northwest and West Coast, as well as Italians. There was quite a few Italians interned there for a while. We didn't see my dad after that, because he was too far away. In Yakima County Jail, we could go visit him. It was about 18 miles away, and we'd crank up the truck and we'd go visit him. But we didn't see him until after we were in Portland Assembly Center, and then when they were transshipping us to Wyoming, the train stopped at Missoula. And so he met us at the railroad depot, and so we saw him for the first time in about, it must have been 6 months or so in there. No, not quite that long, about 4 months. And then shortly after that, though, they released him from the Missoula detention area there, because they found that most of those people weren't really any serious threat or anything like that, and they were better off just putting them into the regular camps. And that's how. So he joined us in Heart Mountain. Anyway, and then as he after the war, because he was still an alien. They were going to deport him, and this was one of these things, like a hanging sword over his head. And I can remember a few times when we stayed out of school because the authorities were going to come by and pick him up to deport him, send him back to Japan. And then as we were waiting there, then some car would come up and say, "Well, we're not going to do it today. We may have to. We'll wait for another time." And this happened a couple of other, about three times. I can remember, and that's kind of disconcerting, I can tell you. and finally they had to have a special act of Congress, the United States Congress, to allow persons like him to stay in the United States. And that just kind of circumvented all these immigration administrative laws and things that they had he had to overcome in order to stay in the United States. And so he got to stay, and he was preparing himself to get the naturalization papers. He started about the first year of about a normal 5-year process, but he passed away of cancer in 1952. To give you an idea of how it was after we returned from the Heart Mountain, Wyoming, where we repatriated back into the valley, in 1945 there was about 1,000 Japanese in the Yakima Valley. We had a whole community there. There was about three different churches, Buddhist, Methodist, and another. I can't remember what the third church was. There was business people that had businesses and things. And of that 1,000 people that were there prior to World War II, only about 250 returned. And so that made that whole community a little bit smaller. We had churches that were no longer active, and we had, like the Buddhist church, they had their own church, a rectory, and a huge community hall, about the same size as the BC down there, the Village Center. It had a basketball court, stage up in front, and some side rooms, and with kitchens and things like that. And matter of fact, that's where we stayed when we came right back out of Heart Mountain, Wyoming, because there was no housing wasn't available, and so we temporarily stayed in that community center, the Buddhist church that had. And those must have been all 5 or 6 families in there. There was a lot of little side rooms that they could kind of set up your own household, and with the central kitchen we could eat and things like that. And so we got to Yakima Valley again in October of 1945, and it took us about another month to arrange housing in an adjacent town called Toppenish. And so I didn't really start school until November of 1945. I was able to continue my education, didn't have any trouble picking up on it. But my younger sister, who was starting the first grade, they wouldn't admit her because it was just a little bit too late for her to adjust for first grade. Well, anyway, the United States government were trying their best trying to make our reentry back into the Yakima Valley as smooth as they could. And one of the items that they did to mitigate some of our hard times was to have a program that was to, for economic reasons, of losses that we might have sustained while we were farming or prior to going in. My parents didn't own their farm or anything, but we did have some horses and equipment things like that that we had to sell when we left to go into the camps at the distress sale. I mean, you were only getting just very little money, or people were picking them up, for whatever they could. And you had to sell your lease, you had to sell all your equipment and all. Anyway, and so we would try it, and so we put a claim in for what our losses were, you know, fair market value. Okay. And after we did all that, the government came back and said, well, would you be willing to take half of what your claim that you claim, and we'll see if we can make this the process go a little faster. Well, then they said, oh yeah, well, okay, it's not that much money, and you know, we didn't want to wait forever, and so we did that. Then they came, no sooner did that, you know, and then they asked it again. And so, will you take a half of what you just, the half that you took? Okay. And then we said yes again. And then they did it one more time. So we ended up with 12 and a half cents on the dollar of the claim. Okay. But that's not the worst part about it. It took 10 years from the time that you put the claim in until you got your check. Our lawyer, he didn't take a fee, and he apologized. He apologized for that travesty of justice. And that just, you know, those are some of the kinds of things that happen. It's unfortunate, but and for some it can cause some pretty bitter feelings, because a lot of people lost, you know, all their household goods that were stored and things like this, memories, you know, their photographs and stuff like that just can't be placed, and you can't put any intrinsic value, you know, because they're but these are some of the real things that did happen. As part of this overall restitution and taking care of things, George Bush, President George Bush the Elder, he finally sent a letter of apology to me, saying that he's sorry that all these events happened, and along with the apology, sent a $20,000 check. Okay, and my younger siblings, they received a similar letter. This one here was signed by President Clinton, with the $20,000 check. For me, this windfall was a nice windfall, and so I used part of it to for a trip to Japan. But the sad thing about it is we're talking about something that's in the 90s, and this happened in the 40s, so it's about 50 years. And many of the older the internees that were parents and older, I was just a teenage kid, and you know, from 9 years old to 12, and so I my remembrance of it is not camp wasn't that traumatic. But some of the older internees that were there, they passed on, and so when they passed on, they didn't there wasn't any inheritance rights. They just didn't get any money, okay. And so you couldn't pass it on to your children or anything else like that. And so what happens is that they as the number of people grow older and the pool gets smaller, then the amount of money they can distribute per person gets to be a little bit greater, and that's part of, you know, how they mitigated all that. I mean, that's and when you think about it, I don't think that the $20,000 didn't mean a heck of a lot to me, but the apology did. So part of the, you know, impact that I see and what I find out, you know, what when I sometimes, I know, like Peter asked me some questions and I never even really thought about it, you know, whether serving my country in the Army, whether, you know, did I feel that I was that while I was in the camp, that was that equivalent to serving my country? Things like this, and it just never passed my mind, I guess. I think a lot of it is that, you know, you still, United States is still my country for whatever it did to me and whatever it did to my parents and things like this. I don't want to say that I'm not going to have anything to do with it. That's not the case. It's just that I'm disappointed in some of the things that they did, but all in all, it's still one of the best countries around, and I've been in a lot of places. But one of the things that I guess we learned, that I personally learned, is to get an education and to get ahead. I know that I've been fortunate in having a lot of good mentors and people helping me out in school, in high school, and neighbor farmers and things like this, and even at working at Boeing. You work with some bosses are better than others at bringing you along and being the mentor. The other thing that happens, you know, the impact that happens to the Japanese community is, I think a lot of it, the Japanese community were integrated a lot more because of the war, and they spread out all over the United States. They got into more different types of occupations, like in the Yakima Valley, it was probably 80% were farmers, okay, and in other areas, and now they've moved into the other cities and taken on other types of jobs, not only, you know, sociologically and geographically and with economic status and all. But nonetheless, some of the residual things that you have, there's a divisiveness in within the community of the Japanese community. During the war, there was a Japanese American Citizen League, and they were working fairly closely with the government and were trying to get what they were doing was having the people in the camps to adjust and to be good citizens, join the army, do, you know, not to cause any civil, any uprisings and things like this. And they were the ones that got the $20,000 and the apology. So they've done very, you know, a lot of good things. But there was also a lot of people that thought that the government had overreached and didn't provide due process, and so they had curfews, and some people would have some civil disobedience. I'm a citizen. Why should I have to do this? Be indoors by dark just because I'm Japanese, and some of those kinds of issues brought a lot of divisiveness within the Japanese community. It has taken almost until just last year or so when the Japanese American Citizen League had acknowledged that those people that had done those civil disobedience and said that they would not serve in the army because their civil rights were abdicated, that they were just as right as the heroes that were fought in the war. And it's taken us 50 years to get over it too. So you know, that healing process takes a long time. And I guess my biggest thing that I could say about what we're talking about here today is that we can do things, and we think that at the time it's a very rash and a very good thing to do. You know, we're going to fight terrorism, and to fight terrorism, we're going to do things, but we may not really think the whole process through, where we might be trampling on all those amendments and amendments to our Constitution and things like this. And and some of these things are so controversial and so that they fester for 50 years, 40 years in the wilderness. Okay, it really is. I don't know how else to say, you know, how to give it to make that statement, but. Because a lot of times, even though you go through it, you still don't know that you went through it, or you still haven't. You don't get the aha. I guess I would say, you know, do unto others as you like to have done to you. That I think is the most, you know, the universal thing. And if you could use that as a guide to whatever you do, you know. Do unto others as you would like to have done to you.
Thanks, Pat. So what messages does this... how do people feel about our present situation? Or how are your congregations looking at this? And has there been any outreach to the Muslim community of... You know, people that are responsible citizens in our towns, and what actions can we take, Carl?
Well, I'm not asking the question, but I just remember a quote that I heard in this field 3 weeks ago from Bonhoeffer that I never heard, but I've really given it a lot of thought. And it was, peace is the opposite of security. And I really thought a lot about that. But I was wondering if you would, can you give us a rundown of what the Patriot Act. What are the main points? Isn't there something there about bookstores keeping track of the books that everybody buys so that the government can see what you're reading?
I've got some sketchy reports, copies of things off the internet. I asked my office to send me a copy of the Patriot Act, but they haven't got it to me yet and things like that. So I don't have any really comprehensive view of it. I know that in general terms there are substantial new powers that have been given to the executive branch of the government. The executive branch of the government is who controls both the investigative functions like the CIA and the FBI and the military reports to the executive branch of the government. And so some of the things that have happened, there has been a very broad definition of terrorism, which some commentators are concerned could even include like people who are protesting against administration policies or people who harbor those sort of people. There have been some increased rights given to surveillance and to internet snooping and those sort of things. There have been increased relaxations in search and seizure applications to come out for searches, and whether or not there are instances now where the person doesn't have to be informed that there has been a search, whereas that's always been a requirement under the Fourth Amendment. In these immigration cases, some things that have come out are that the government has refused to indicate who is being held and has refused to give them the right to an attorney. The military tribunal is going to conduct secret trials rather than public trials, as is your right if you're in the regular court system. It's very unclear as to what all the safeguards are, but I think the rules of evidence are going to be relaxed. And a lot of these other things we've been talking about that any person who's facing a criminal charge has are going to be changed and relaxed. And the death penalty can be imposed by the military tribunal. So some of our due process rights, some of our privacy rights, And certainly some of the First Amendment rights that we've been talking about, there at least will be a chilling effect. Like when Attorney General Ashcroft says things like that, it has what's called a chilling effect. That's people are less likely to fully exercise some of the rights they have. Rights to dissent, rights to associate with various people, rights to join a particular mosque, right to join particular groups, when they know that there's general disfavor and there is more snooping going on. The wiretapping has been changed too. In other words, ever since Martin Luther King was wiretapped, they really changed and tightened up a lot of those requirements. And now basically we're back to where we were before, you know, all that kind of surveillance was going on. So, and many of these rights that have been changed most dramatically or are being obviously done now are in the immigration setting, and they're not for citizens. And so the challenge is here, you know, are we going to be concerned because we aren't people that fit that particular category? Because we are citizens, probably most of us in this room are citizens, or is it a time when, you know, we are called to speak out? So that, in very general terms, are some of the places where there have been erosion of these civil liberties.
What is your solution then? No erosion?
Well,
I mean, we have to give up certain... You have the right to get a fire family in a theater.
Yeah, but that was the same before.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But we have to give up a few of these things. But where do you draw the line?
That's my...
Are you saying no line to be drawn?
Well, where the line gets drawn in, and I'm not here to tell you the answer. I'm kind of looking for you to tell me the answer. Where the line gets drawn traditionally, I know how that gets drawn. It gets drawn in a court of law, and the one side advocates as hard as they can for complete liberties, and the other side advocates as completely as they can for none, and a judge makes the decision. Now, the judiciary is kind of being removed from this process. It's more going into the lap of increased executive powers. So one question is, how do we have control about that if a lot of those deliberations aren't public or we don't have direct input? So my question is kind of a broad one. Yours to me is broad too. So I don't know exactly where you draw the line. Do we draw it differently after September 11th? And if so, how differently do we draw it? I guess that's one of the questions.
I think one of the big challenges is that I don't think this has changed because of September 11th. I mean, the reality is that the know-how, increasingly the ability for some of these other non-governmental groups or governmental groups to possess weapons of mass destruction, that's been out there. September 11th, I think, kind of brought the point home that there are groups that are willing to commit acts such as this. And I think the challenge that poses is how do you balance all of these rights, sort of the life that we all enjoy, the liberties we all enjoy, with dealing with some of those realities of, you know, the what if. I mean, you know, I think the government goes too far now to scare people, but there's also the potential of somebody sneaking a bomb into a city with you know, tens of thousands of casualties or a chemical attack or some other type of incident where the penalties for failure to stop that act are significantly greater than in the past when if you know something happened where, and not to put a value on one life versus a thousand, but certainly you know something in the past where you had an incident where one or two or three people were killed, that has a very different impact than September 11th did, or something that's at a bigger scale than potentially September 11th. So the question is, how do you balance that, the, you know, sort of the increased penalties of failure to stop a potential act versus maintaining the life that we all enjoy today.
Difficult questions.
Yeah. One thing I've asked myself over and over again is, how many rights of another person am I willing to give away that I wouldn't be willing to give away of my own? And I'm a public school teacher in a mid-sized town in Oregon. On September 28th, I was asked by my administrator to remove one of my assistants who's Muslim and is a woman and dresses in her garb. When I blew the whistle on him, it went through two people, two administrators, before a third would act on it. And he was censured. But I was naive enough to think that my righteous indignation about firing this woman because she comes to school in her garb would be immediately and unequivocally supported. And it's part of my grief since then that it hit me personally on September 28th. And so I really had been grappling with that all the rest of the year, is that in this small town in southern Oregon, this came home to roost with me on the 28th of September. And so I've really had to think about that ever since.
Did you feel, in taking the position you did, at all un-American? In other words, did you feel like you should have followed that order?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've never questioned that.
Well, I think then the question becomes, you raise a really good point, in taking a stand against something like that, does that make us un-American? Or does that, do people look at us as being un-American because we're not supporting the party line, so to speak? Or is that really what America is all about, where people have the right to be treated as we would like to be treated, and where people here have the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty? And so I think that maybe what we need to look at is what defines an American.
How about you? Do you have a thought as to what is an American?
Well, I think that one of the reasons I choose to live in this country is because I have the right to think my own thoughts. I have the right to privacy. I have the right to surf the internet without having people looking over my shoulder. I have the right to check out whatever book from the library I want, even if it's about making a bomb. I have the right to move about at will within this country. I have the right to purchase a firearm if I want. I have the right to a trial by jury if somebody thinks I'm guilty of something, rather than to live in a place where if I have a Muslim friend who happens to belong to a mosque where possibly someone's funneling money to the Middle East, all of a sudden I am now a suspect. And that scares me. It scares me that who I choose to associate with may presume my guilt without the rights that I'm entitled to as someone born in this country, and without the rights that anyone else who is a citizen of this country should be entitled to. And that concerns me greatly. Any erosion of someone else's rights in this country, I believe, is an erosion of mine.
What scares me is, I think a lot of this stuff, I can understand why this patriot stuff and everything is being done, but my concern is that, in general, I think the focus is directly connected with September 11th, directly connected with racial profiling, or I would call it that, and we're looking out there and everybody is them, and there's a lot of fear and paranoia being stirred up. My concern is, if I heard you right, this law is talking about non-citizens. So all of this stuff can happen to non-citizens.
are we looking for the same stuff that's possibly happening among citizens? I mean, Oklahoma City. There are other examples. And are we putting all of our paranoia eggs in one basket? All of our fear of terrorism in one thing? That really concerns me, the racial profiling, whether it's African-American, whether it's Muslim, whether it's Croatian, whether it's Bosnian. I mean, it really bothers me. I lived for a while in another country and lived with a lot of this security stuff. And there is no security without justice. No true security without justice, without me seeing God in the other. And as Christians, I'm really bothered. I'm bothered by people I work with who I hear talking about this concern about, this is an example. Okay, this is an example. The Pledge of Allegiance taking out the wording under God. They want it in there, but they want it in there under their perception of God and their perception of who and how I worship and pray. They want prayer in the public schools under the way they define prayer. But in America, we don't all define prayer the same way. And so they want to hold out for what they figure is, or they feel is a right for them on one end, but not for the other. Well, we can't, as Americans, we can't do that. And that's where the problem lies, I think. And so all this racial profiling, deciding who is the other, where is the enemy who we now want to look as out there may truly be here.
There have been, I know some people quoted recently as saying that America is a Christian nation, and I think that is becoming part and parcel with a lot of the patriotism now. Of course, it's not specifically by the congregation that state is not allowed to support a religion, and we are very pluralistic in terms of our nation, but somehow the Christianity has kind of risen to the forefront here. I know in terms of the people who have been detained so far, they are almost all Arab men and Muslims who have been detained, you know, without trial. And talked to my partner since I've been out here, and I asked him how business was. He does criminal defense work, largely white collar defense and things like that. And I said, "How's business?" And he says, "Terrible. The FBI is spending all their time talking to young Arab males in South Minneapolis. Nobody's been charged with white collar crime in the last year."
Which brings up another point. It's another issue of national security, the current corruption within corporate America.
Right.
And is that a greater threat than some of the other?
Poor savings, sure.
Poor security.
You know, for me, Pete, I traveled to Morocco and Algeria and all over that area, and the people I met there were incredibly kind to a wealthy American. You know, even though I was a backpacker as a student, it's incredible how generous they were to me and how beautiful all those people were. And where was all of the American indignation towards the government before September 11th? All the sanctions, all the kids in these countries dying of starvation because of our boycotts and sanctions, and all the arms smuggling, all the CIA undercover dirty dealings that have gone on, and to prop up one Khomeini with another and then remove one and then try to take another one down. Where was everyone's concern before September 11th? I mean, this anger of the terrorists isn't representative of all the people, but they've been dealt such a terrible blow by our country for so long. They really have nothing in those countries whatsoever. The fact that people are upset now at Muslims, you know, after this thing and is amazing to me, because, you know, what a small handful of extremists can do, and then round up a bunch of Arab Americans and then, you know, put them, make them run the gauntlet again, seems just incredible to me.
Who in this room or your congregation has had some outreach to Muslims or Muslim communities? And there may not be many in some areas, but we did a little study this winter, and we were surprised at looking at ourselves, how we had a lot of the biases that are projected, you know, about Islam being violent and mistreatment of women and all those sorts of things. And then as we started thinking, those of us who knew a Muslim, we were having a much different experience, much more like what Alex was talking about. I've got a buddy in Minneapolis that I play guitar with every 2 weeks, and he's a PhD engineer for a firm back there, and we're good friends. And I wonder how his life is now. He's trying to get his wife to immigrate to St. Paul.
I live in a community that has a small Muslim mosque, and the mosque had some paint sprayed on there after September 11th, and there was a huge outpouring of neighbors to take care of that right away and let them know that they were not going to be. In Seattle, there was a mosque that was attacked right away, and there was a variety of people from various churches, Jewish, Christian, different denominations of Christian, that turned sitting on the steps of that church for several weeks, or of the mosque, to protect it. So I think many people are not as concerned about their neighbors, Muslims, and the Muslim religion as they more fear, at least the people that I've been around, the ones that come in the country as illegal, or, you know, come as travelers on visas and don't leave, and things like that, rather than the neighbors they meet every day. I don't think they fear the ones around, but they fear the stranger that's new in the mix.
I serve in a church in Jerusalem, and I just wanted to tell those of you who were here during the aftermath of September 11th how really moved and proud I was of the overwhelming, not the entire, but the overwhelming American response in terms of trying to understand Islam, in terms of watching out for rights being trampled. I was really, really struck by that. And I think that the ground that prepared that was the fact that we do take our rights very seriously, and as Americans, and when we begin to give those up, then we can look toward all kinds of abuses of people, and nobody standing up to say that's not what we ought to be doing.
Ben, we're just about out of time. Do you have anything you'd like to say in closing?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned in my conclusion there about, I think that we, you know, try to do things unto others as we'd like to have done unto ourselves. I think that kind of sums up a good way for us to really look at some of these thorny issues and come at it from a personal side on how you would do and how you would like to have somebody do something for you. And you in turn could do the same thing. See? So that like those people that went to that Muslim church there and took the pain off, okay, that's maybe, you know, if that happened to your church, you'd sure appreciate it. If some other church group came by and took the pain off. in the same, I think this is a, so I think that my particular conclusion is that, you know, goodwill begets more goodwill.
A question for you is, someone who has had some experience with the federal government and being a prosecutor, how long do you think it would be before this act is struck down as being totally unconstitutional?
You know, if I think the act probably never would have got passed, and a lot of it would have been found unconstitutional right away if it weren't for September 11th, and I think almost any judge who would have that predisposition now is going to be reluctant in our given situation. People think of the law as a very refined scientific thing, and I think after the last election contest when it went all the way to the Supreme Court, everyone has seen there is a lot more politics and those sort of things that, you know, come into effect. And so the constitutional protections are really what the Supreme Court says they are. In other words, the breadth of your right to privacy from eavesdropping, wiretapping, searches and seizures is what those nine people say it is. And so the balance in that court right now is not a liberal one. And so some of the obvious provisions could get struck down, but many of it could survive now because of the climate. And where we all draw the line is a tough question. The gentleman back there asked me where I would draw the line. I would like to keep all of my rights. I would also like to have a safe and secure country, and I think one of the ways to begin that is to avoid having an injustice again like happened to Ben. So I think a good place to start is to reach out and make sure that we aren't profiling and we aren't drawing conclusions about someone just because they're of a different culture than we. Thank you all very much for coming.